Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many such lodges situated around the world. And no matter where you would drop in for a Sunday morning meeting, or maybe another day of the week, you would hear virtually the same rendition of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. However, each of these lodges, each of the study centers are autonomous because, frankly, it's the declared purposes that bind together all students associated with the Theosophical movement. And other than that free-willed association with the Theosophical movement and these few declared purposes, there really is no organization in the modern sense of a structure. There's no bylaws, tithing, dues, officers. All of that is put aside, and the Declaration rules, if you will, the purposes of all the efforts of the volunteers. The volunteer system here in Philadelphia, in keeping with this Declaration, has an aim of keeping the pure line of Theosophy as brought forth into the Western world in the late 1800s, that's the focus of the effort. And the work on hand is to do a couple of things. In individual avenues, away from the meetings at the lodge, associated students may devote themselves in study, meditation, self-discipline efforts at developing an ethical character, and those efforts, along with the public efforts of keeping the philosophy before the public eye and ear, is so that the philosophy of itself, the truth of universal brotherhood, the truth of what the true nature of the human being is, the truth of a conviction that universal brotherhood can be placed into practice in daily life. That's the focus of the philosophy, and that's what all the efforts in these public rooms are about. So frankly, whether a soul somewhere in the world has heard the word Theosophy or not, if indeed there's an individual working solo somewhere in the world or in Philadelphia, wherever, regardless of conditions of life, if that soul is focused on the true service of humanity to liberate and uplift thought and motive and action at every plane, such a one is considered a Theosophist. And that would be the aspiration of someone who volunteers to take part in the efforts here in Philadelphia. So if you're interested in taking part in keeping the building open or study classes or fitting yourself to be the better able to help and teach others in some ways, you could always talk to the individual who's volunteering at the book table and get some advice on how to go about volunteering for the cause. So having said that, those of us that are already committed, keep the building open. I was going to say alive. Isn't that an interesting? Keep the building alive and open on Sunday mornings. 10:30, the front door opens. There's always someone at the book table to assist if you want to purchase a piece of literature to use at home. And then promptly at 11, punctuality is a big deal, 11 to 12, there is a formal presentation of the philosophy. This morning, we were going to have a forum talk entitled The Law of Justice and Mercy. It's the second in a series of five talks in the umbrella topic of synthesis of science and religion. So science and religion is the general subject for November. Next week, on November 15th, Karmic Challenges in Life is the title for the consideration. Now, Wednesday nights, the building is also open. The doors open at 5:15. There's a small, high-quality reference library. We don't have the wherewithal to do a lending library, but we do collect straight-line theosophical materials for anyone that wants to come in and research any topic. That library is always equipped with one or two volunteers ready, willing, and able to assist a private search. And the library stays open from 5:15 to 7:15. At 7:30, promptly on Wednesday evenings, there's a study class in this room. It's slightly less formal than what goes on a Sunday morning. And this winter, from 7:30 to 8:30, every Wednesday night, there will be a study class where the student who's volunteered to chair will help with a mutual study of an article in The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. That little book is priceless. It is a collation of newspaper articles from the late 1800s. You might even say it's kind of a Reader's Digest version of the SD in some ways. But it's a wonderful study. And no matter how many times we've turned our minds back to the study of the ocean, there's something always a little bit new that pops off the pages. So if you're interested in purchasing anything before or after Sunday, Wednesday classes, you can use the book table. If you're interested in volunteering in any way, talk to the person at the desk at the book table. If they're busy, you know, maybe you could talk to the usher or someone else who's nearby. But please consider picking up a little periodical. It's wonderful food for thought. And promise, the Declaration's magnificent. I've been babbling on, but the Declaration's a beauty. So without further ado, we have a volunteer who is going to offer us thoughts this morning on the law of justice and mercy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There was a standing joke among a certain religious group that went, when you meet with God, don't ask for justice, plead for mercy. Our understanding is often betrayed by our false assumptions. Assumptions that have been inherited or adopted from the customs, culture, religion, etc., of our societies. We often assume that two ends of the same idea are separate, not realizing that the two ideas are of the same source and differ only by degrees. Some examples of this logic are love and hate, spirit and matter, man and woman, justice and mercy. These apparent opposites are not distinctly separated from one another, but share a common spectrum. This morning, our concern is with justice and mercy. In the Judeo-Christian influenced Western nations, the concept of justice and mercy hinges upon the idea and understanding of the word sin and the concept of sin that we have inherited. The concept implies an external force or being whose wrath and anger are to be avoided at all costs. This external force or being can deprive your crops of rain, spread disease among your livestock, strike down your firstborn. All of this and more from its arsenal of calamities. In Webster's New World Dictionary, the definition of sin is an offense against God, religion, or good morals. As you can see, the sin concept lacks the subtleties and depth required to deal with man's complex nature. It is consistent in addressing transgressions and punishments, while hardly noticing positive actions and really addressing motivation. In order to understand the law of justice and mercy, we need a deeper view of right and wrong. A wider net to capture and understand man's actions and their repercussions, no matter how subtle, and to what their motivations may be. During the latter half of the 19th century, the word karma was introduced into Western thought and vernacular. Over the years, the word became popular, but a true understanding of the concept has been slow. What then is karma, and how can it be just and merciful simultaneously? Karma is the continuance of a thought or act, and each act or thought contains within itself the past and future. Every effect has a causal root. Just as there can be no tree limbs without a tree trunk and a root system, there are no effects without a cause, and there can be no cause without a being to make it and feel its effect. Karma doesn't just address transgressions, but all actions and their motivations. Its purpose is to maintain universal equilibrium on every level of existence. The scientific discipline of physics states that for every action, there is an equal reaction. Theosophy concurs, further informing us that these reactions are not propelled by revenge, anger, or spite, but by impersonal law, which demonstrates through its observable actions that we live in a universe of moral order as well as physical order, and its movement towards that end is inevitable. With this basic knowledge of the law of karma digested, we can begin to see a field where justice and mercy can and must exist. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. This Bible quote sheds light on the power that man has over his destiny, power that through knowledge can be wrested from the grip of that mysterious external force of a being. The power and responsibility to examine and learn from his yesterdays and shape his tomorrows. The justice of karma is illustrated in the following quote from The Secret Doctrine. It is only because that mankind has ever shut its eyes to the great truth that man is himself his savior and his own destroyer, that he need not accuse heaven and the gods, fates and providence of the apparent injustice that reigns in the midst of humanity. Karma is proof that justice is seated in the very center of universal law, and that man has the power to administer it, but needs only knowledge and the will to do so. The law of karma is beneficent, wholly merciful, relentlessly just, for true mercy is not favor, but impartial justice. If karma wasn't merciful, we would have been wiped from existence long ago. The fact that the oppressors, the unjust, the wicked, continue out their lives is proof of mercy woven into the fabric of nature. The oppressors, the unjust, the wicked are given many chances to correct the errors of their lives and take up their lives' true aim and purpose, which is the pursuit of perfection. Martin Luther King once said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but bends towards justice." And in Aphorisms on Karma, Mr. Judge informs us further by saying, karma is both merciful and just. Mercy and justice are only opposite poles of a single whole, and mercy without justice is not possible in the operations of karma.
Thank you. In a land where law is the heritage of a long line of thinking from Hammurabi through Rome, through England, and till now, law and order, justice and mercy are major issues. I'm sure you came here this morning with your own thoughts on karma in particular. Yeah.
Was had during the talk in regards to what mercy was, we were really taken back. We had never thought of mercy as the way it was described in the talk, because we were thinking karma definitely is justice, because it's the justice depending upon what you do, you reap those effects. Whereas our thought with mercy, it was like mercy was an exception. Like somebody could do something bad, and then somebody could say, well, I'll dispense some mercy, and you know, you don't have to take the responsibility. But it sounds as though mercy is almost like a higher aspect of justice. Or did we misunderstand that?
Mm-hmm. If sometimes we in studying these new concepts, we trip over conditions that we've actually got mentally because of our upbringing. And mercy in this nation frequently has to do with vicarious atonement. Someone else offered their sacrifice, so all my sins are forgiven. Mercy is oftentimes an underlying supposition that the governor or someone in office is going to wave a magic wand, and a sentence or a punishment in the court system is going to disappear. But mercy starts at home, isn't it? If mercy and justice is a continuum, in a certain way, aren't they both at one in love, in compassion? So we may look at a scenario in our family, in our family of origin, in our family of chosen friends, and we may see a real dichotomy in thinking and action, and sparks might even really start to fly. Those of us who are maybe more controlled want justice, fix this, and you know, there should be a one-on-one linear cause effect immediately. Other folks might stand back and say, wow, you know what? I've done something similar. Now that I see it mirrored to me, this might be the motivation, or this might be how that works, and how can I assist in that scenario? How do I mitigate it, if you will? So just the loving, compassionate law of karma that allows each of us to use free will and choice. We have plenty of wiggle room to consider our motives and to design our words and our actions. And we can be confident that in that cause and effect, action and reaction, we will get the information back to us that will help us perfect whatever we're doing. That's merciful. That's room for growth. And that's a loving, compassionate system of thought. Yeah.
We were thinking if a student failed an important exam,
yeah,
and the teacher said, well, I'll be merciful here, we'll give you a passing grade. Is that really mercy? No. It only gives you something on paper. You don't have the reality. Mercy is to allow the person to try it again, to work harder, to learn the material, and take the test over. So our idea of mercy is getting away with something, mm-hmm, and nature won't let that happen.
Nature won't let that happen, and who wants the physician or the lawyer who was the bottom of the class, who was mercifully allowed to slide through? Yes?
So mercy is therefore the fact that this action and reaction is constantly happening. that it not stored up somewhere, and then one day we die and we bring it back with us,
mm-hmm.
that we have the ability to keep on generating new causes. And we're actually, if we are told to be aware of ourselves and around us. And that is the one thing which we lose contact with.
And if we don't want to go too far into next week's talk about karmic conditions or challenges in life, but as we look around, the point that this is a process, and maybe the folks behind the commenter couldn't see the hands going in a circle. The fact that karma unfolds spiritually for us, mentally or intellectually for us, and also physically or astrally for us, it unfolds in those three different ways. We're told that when the condition is right, a stored karmic effect will come to us. Well, when the conditions are right, we are in a circumstance as perceivers where we're living in a body, in an astral sense of powers. We're living in a particular ability to think through a physical brain. And here come the effects that we ourselves have engendered or energized. But in that circumstance, if the conditions are right and the karma comes in a gradual way, then we have the confidence that with patience and endurance, we can look coolly at what the circumstances are and make a new choice, maybe a better choice, maybe on a pure motive, and grow spiritually, not only for the individual, but for everybody around. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, we always thought that as humanity, as man, we are not so much concerned, we are right now, though, with the physical aspects, but that's not what's important. You know, and that there's that spiritual nature,
mm-hmm.
that is compelling us to move forward. It's there. It's part of nature's law. The harmony and the justice that if we understand that we are creating everything right now,
mm-hmm.
for our future. Right now,
mm-hmm.
by how we're thinking, how we're acting, what we're listening to, you know
mm-hmm.
this whole, we are creating a future.
We're creating a future and we're mitigating the effects of past karma. You know, if we picture a boiling pot on a stove, once the pot is spilled onto a person's hand, it's too late. But in all the moments that lead up to that event, there's plenty of time for free will and choice and awareness, wisdom, and knowledge to figure out how to put the handle of the pot so it faces the back of the stove, to be sure that the pot sits as back far, that our sleeves don't in some way entangle in the cooking apparatus. There are many, many steps we can take to mitigate or maybe even prevent an occurrence of karma. It's all by law, and we're all working with that all the time. Your hand's been up
well,
and down.
Just because the future takes too darn long to get here. Yes, we have created this thing, and we have the ability to perceive it and will and choose, but we're also quite often stupid and emotional about it at the time. So the future of really dealing with it takes quite a while and a strong nature.
And that statement, that comment, is probably the typical American mindset that we need to look at. If we want everything hurry up, instant, right now, ready, fast food, fast coffee, instant rice, you know, this, that, and the other thing, we as a group are working in a cultural influence and a sphere of spiritual influence, if you will, where fast, 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 immediate response, immediate solutions may be what's desired. But as thinkers, we can stand back from that and that recognize, oh, wait a minute, there's the urge to hurry up and do what I see needs to be done. And all caution to the wind with somebody else's input. When in reality, we can step back and say, whoa, well, the future is now. All moments are now. What can I do proactively in this moment to assure peace and harmony? I have a need. Okay, how can I do that so that 2 or 3 months from now it doesn't bloom into a crisis for somebody else? And the philosophy would be a great study on time and perspective and perception. You know, I started the sentence in the past. I'm going to finish the sentence in the future. But frankly, I'm only speaking in the now. So the future's not so far off. The causes we set up right now are sowing a character and a destiny for the future. And your hand was...
Well, what we have found very helpful in changing our perspective a little bit is that in Hindu cosmology, which some of it is found in the secret doctrine and, of course, the ocean of theosophy, but the number of years that have been charted and, you know, the Dendidran calendar of 75,000 years is found in Egypt, and our concept of time has to expand. So therefore, our consciousness has to expand. So what's the hurry? Just do what you have to do now.
Just stay in the moment, be proactive, be philosophical, and be unafraid, absolutely unafraid, to look at our thoughts, our actions, and our words, and say, what's to be learned here? You know, frequently we have the little monkey mind that's running, the tape that's running from childhood or from previous traumatic circumstances. You're stupid, you're lazy, you're bad, you're wrong, you're different, you're the other. You know, we could probably go on forever with some of these negative voices that get inside our heads from the environment. And we know that they reflect thinking based on the notion of original sin, the notion of who's big and who's small, who's got power, who doesn't, who can control, who can't. But theosophically, we've got a philosophy that can arm us with this patient insight, this aha, there's that voice again. I'm not that voice. And I'm going to reject that premise way, way in the back.
And part of what was brought up in the talk was about ethics, the moral code, which is what we can think about when we're wrestling with these ideas. Is this idea in line with ethics and morals? If not, it's the wrong idea. And we know we cannot do it if we choose not to do it. If we figure out what is the right thing in line with the harmony of all and the ethics of all and the highest spiritual idea we can imagine, we know we're heading in the right direction. Go, go, go. You know, take that moment and as fast as you like, and pay attention to it and its results.
And in that process of stepping back from passion, personality, physicality, and taking the moment to reflect, what would the Buddha say? What did the Christ say in the Sermon on the Mount? What did Confucius say about improving the entire system of life based on filial piety? When we look at those kind of ethical statements, we need a centered heart and a cool head to be able to do that. If we're lost in the rush of the lower, our motive may be perfect. I need to protect this for the well-being of a particular scenario. Another individual may come along and say, well, I need to protect this for the well-being of another scenario, when in reality the motives are identical. It's only the outer expression of them that's different and that can cause some sparks. Your hand's been up a lot.
When we begin to think about these ideas, most of us in the room, in our physical lives and in our physical environment, we work to create a physical balance, harmony physically. We won't put our hands in fire. We take care of our health. We brush it to anything to preserve our physical environment. Yet, you use the term harmony, then here in these rooms, we learn about those fundamental ideas that tell us that we're not the form, we're using the form. And yet, we put all the attention on our environment, physical environment. Please tell us, where did we get that idea that balances our environment, physical, morally, and spiritually?
Well,
it's a difficult thing to do because we do everything right locally and then things happen to us. Now, we want to.
The philosophy says that just yesterday, 18 million years ago, there was three streams of evolution. Spirit, mind, and matter that came together in such a way that mind was lit up. And humans today are the convergent point. We are the communion. We are the harmony or the unity of those three streams of evolution. And so as the cycles of time have gone on and the pinball machine of karma has continued. We don't have a single clear cause A leads to cause B leads to cause C. Rather, we've got all sorts of intermittent causes at the individual level, in the collective level, and at every level in between. So across time, depending on the soul and the ability and effort to concentrate on soul and identify with soul and express soul, we can identify with the unity of all life, the oneness, the deific essence of spirit, or as thinkers and perceivers, we can use our free will and choice and awareness and identify with the poles of opposites. The illusions of material existence. We can identify with the brain and the personality and the body and get lost in that. Well, karmically, over 18 million years as soul, all of those perceptions are possible. All of those experiments in living were possible. And as soul, as we practice the art of living, the science of life, and we dabbled here and there, we've got all these effects coming back at us. So if we find ourselves today looking at outward conditions and saying, I'm going to focus on the health of this body or the wealth of this home or these physical positions, karmically, that's a tendency that we've developed across many lives, but we can break that pattern, we can mitigate that pattern and step back and say, wait a minute. Am I a poor, sinful sinner, a lowly, sinful person, or am I a perceiver where mind over matter is actually a scientific fact? And acting as mind, acting as soul, acting as one with the collective, do I have a dynamic amount of power to bring to justice and to mercy. And we could be merciful to the personality that we're living in or the body we're living in, and maybe develop a sense of humor along the way and chuckle at the limitations while we go on. Follow up.
Then we've heard of faith, hope, and charity, and the greatest of these is charity.
It's
so
love.
It is that,
yeah.
It's not how I handle my own self, but it's, am I dedicated to the welfare of others when it's required? It seems that we have more weight on the side that we're doing the right thing, you're doing this or that. But it's not about me.
It's about the use of thought and awareness in the moment, as shocking as it might be. Once long ago, on a Wednesday night, this room was arranged in circles. It was an experiment on how to communicate during a study class. And the ocean class, or maybe it was the summertime, maybe it was the Gita class, we were talking about compassion and love and uplifting all planes of existence, and with that, a little fly flew into the circle, and one of the people present slapped the fly and killed it, and everybody else in the circle went, oh, because there it was in the moment of how quickly we get distracted. I would do this, but oops, there's that habit, a reflex that we're not even thinking, we haven't even brought mind to it, yeah.
We remember hearing about a picture they found, a painting on the wall somewhere in Egypt, that when we came before Judgment Day, shall we say, rather than a being, we were judged by a scale where our heart was put on one side, feather on the other. And it so intrigued us. If we can keep that in mind, are we heart beings? Are we always trying to do our very best? Or are we weighed down with the terrestrial difficulties we're having? It's an amazing image. Just wanted to think about.
And we have a phrase in our culture that reflects that Egyptian, a heart, the weight of a feather. We call it lighthearted, don't we? And one who is lighthearted has untethered a soul in a certain way. If thoughts are like bubbles, and we know thoughts pass through our minds all the time, but they're like bubbles. They just kind of burst and go away, and then there's another thought. If we could, very gradually across time and lives and lives and lives, learn to stay lighthearted, to let go, and to recognize, I think and I live in a sea of ideation. And thoughts and concerns and pains and agonies are going to come and go like bubbles. I can stay lighthearted. I can stay spirited. I can stay untethered as a soul if compassionately I just let go. I do the best I can, but don't become attached to the outcome. I'm merciful to the instrumentation I'm using, and bringing down the anxiety, the angst, or the anger, pain, whatever that happens to be, fear maybe. I'm merciful to the instruments being used, and I will therefore be able to serve and be merciful to the next one who I will recognize the same struggle in. There's a book called Just Mercy, describing the court system and what happens to children caught up in the court system. And the point made toward the back of the book is that You can be a stone thrower. You can even throw stones at yourself. Remember the biblical saying, like he who's without sin, cast the first stone. But how much more lighthearted and merciful, loving, and just is it to try to be the stone catcher? To be the karmic agent who relieves and releases and therefore blesses. Yeah.
Just to reiterate what you just said, and perhaps in a different way, justice and mercy. If we're saying that this is the law, this is part of that law, what is there to fear?
Mm-hmm.
What is there to fear? And in the age that we live in, being so material, we're so fascinated by the results.
Yeah.
We're always looking at the results. I mean, hoping for these results or that result, or we do something for this, you know, and our whole life is caught up with that. And if we could trust in our higher nature, trust in the law.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like rest back on the wings of that great bird.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and take repose in that, which is, you know, each one must interpret that for themselves, you know, but it says that we should not struggle like this. You know, we should be aware and constant, because we are moving forward, whether we want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
That is the justice and mercy.
We are moving forward. We're moving forward in cause and effect, in the complexity of those causes and effects. And to trust that way metaphysically, way, way back at the dim ages when the absolute was transitioning and when manifestation would come forth, spirit would come forth from that one pureness, compassion first arose in it. Karma first arose in that, but compassion was the justice and the mercy, the freedom of being an expression of the all, being the expression of the spirit, and not sweating the small stuff. Even at the end of the Gita, you know, when at the end of the Gita, at the end of the Gita study during the summer, chapter 18, where it says, act as seemeth best to thee. Do it. Let go of it. Get a result that you didn't expect or a shocking result inside yourself. Step back and say, oh, wait a minute, something to be learned. And that invitation to learn and to grow and to progress or to spiral, however you want to envision that for yourself, that is the greatest mercy of all. Fear of consequences. You know, with little tiny children in homes, somebody gets slapped upside the head. No words, just bam, gets slapped upside the head. The child learns fear of, uh-oh, I did something wrong, it's going to hurt. As opposed to another home where the lesson might be, oh, that was a mistake. Well, look, you've got a couple of choices here. You can try this, and that might be your outcome. You can try that. This might be your outcome. Make a decision and try it. Two very different kinds of thinking. One merciful, and both consequences of action. But just, yeah, karmic expressions. Yeah.
Well, we have heroes that we have a great deal of respect for. And it appears that it's what they did for others that make them heroes in our thinking. And we bring to mind the idea of the Buddha, the Christ, various other heroes of our modern times. They didn't seem to have very much wealth or what we would call outstanding in the community. It's what they did for others. And even each one of us in our personal lives has someone who sacrificed themselves for their benefit. So it appeared to me that it's not so much about what I less fortunate than I.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that sounds like this great law of karma is not so difficult to understand. As you sow, so shall ye reap. Very simple. But it can get complicated when we go to do it.
If we can look at ourselves as soul perceivers who are trainers, we live in a body, we live through a personality, we live through a brain, that as perceivers we can still train, whether we're 18 or 98, doesn't matter, there's still this potential to train, then making an effort every morning to say, okay, I want to serve life. I want to make theosophy a living power today in my little way, in my little life. And then if we try to hold that as a guideline through the day and make the effort just to constantly come back and try it again. Oh, I snapped at that clerk. Yikes. Or, boy, I was really impatient at that restaurant. Catching that and saying, whoa, what kind of habit is that that I mean to put that out there? That kind of habit, saying hello, being a smiling person, being aware if somebody else needs a little assistance, we gradually set up a habit of being aware and serving others. Is that a physical expression? Yes, but there has to be an idea and a motive before the word or the deed occurs. And in all of the world's great religions, karma, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. All of them. This is a non-theosophical book set up by somebody who's a scholar of religious thought. And the collections of quotes are from Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Confucianism, Hinduism, and Sikhism. Almost word for word. Yeah.
The only problem with holding on to or focusing on as ye sow, so shall ye reap, is the expectation that what I'm doing now in the right way, in a better way, is going to give me results now. But we're leaving out the other side of the picture. As ye are reaping, you must have sown. So you have to review what's coming to you and mm-hmm. deal with that in the same way you're creating better things for the future. Again, the future takes a while to get here.
And in creating the future, if the emphasis is on I and me, the premise is wrong. If the Gita tells us if we're attached to the outcome, so one of the earlier comments was about how material we are, we quantify everything. We fret about, comparative judgments of who's got what. We misinterpret other people's words because we've heard them a different way. If our thought process is more along the lines of we are in manifestation as part of a collective, and that cause and effect, that cycle, that wave of outgoing and return affects everyone, and we think we can rock the boat very easily for large numbers of people without even thinking about it, then better as we review the day, as we set a tone for the day, we're not thinking about immediate, fast consequences or benefits for me, but rather we try to step back and do what that Hindu cosmology does. It's staggering when you look at the skillions of years on these charts of how long something proceeds in terms of cycle. If we can step back from that and just stop for a minute and try to envision the best for the whole, a golden age of no war, a golden age in which everyone has enough to eat, and the ability to think for themselves and use free will and choice to benefit all, would be a very different outcome.
Try an experiment. There was checker at the supermarket near where we used to live who just always seemed sour. So people wouldn't talk to her, and she wouldn't talk to people. She would just ring you up and send you on your way. So I decided I would, a little bit at a time, say hello each time, even if she didn't say it back. And eventually, we got to talking, and she was wrestling with cancer. Mm-hmm. And there was no way anyone could have known that had they not taken the time to think, those shoes could be the shoes that I'm wearing. I might have suffered what she's suffering. And it was a wonderful lesson.
It is a wonderful lesson. You know, we know the burdens or the traumas that we carry as thinkers within our particular personal development or our family line or in our ethnic group or our racial group, all of those conditions. But true mercy, absolutely true mercy, the sweetness of love given in a gentle statement of, I see what you're doing, I appreciate why you're doing it, but there's another way to look at it. The sweetness and the gentleness of trying to be merciful and harmonious, even if we don't like the other person. You know, sometimes we get a vibration. We'll walk into a room and you think, ooh, that person's not somebody I want to talk to. Well, going out on the limb and saying, I don't know what that vibration's about, but let's try it. Let's offer mercy instead of judgment and indifference or some other negative thing. Why not do some compassionate pleasantry service of the other and try to find the oneness behind all these masks? Too often, if somebody's poor, if somebody's condemned for some reason, we go with the herd in our thinking without ever stopping to consider, I know what my conditions have been in this life. I can only imagine what conditions might have been in another life. What might that soul be carrying around as a burden? Yeah.
It was said earlier, thinking about doing good. I think Mother Teresa said, rather than thinking about doing good, do good.
Mm-hmm. And your comment, that quote, how many times, and this student will be on the top of the list, how many times has a thought or an impulse occurred where, gee, I could do X, Y, Z to help, and then we procrastinate or daydream or defer or whatever you want to call it, and we don't act on it. Are those intuitive moments, are those flashes of true soul knowledge of when and how to help mitigate karma? Maybe so. Yeah.
Well, you have to trust that it is. And you have to go with that feeling. And you have to investigate it. But, you know, if you love yourself, you will trust yourself.
But which self?
Well,
the personal, the brain, or the soul is eternity?
We're only talking about that which is the witness.
Ah,
all this
okay.
That takes place.
Okay, so soul as
You're
witness.
All that. We're all that.
Yes,
all
and in some ways, when we talk about soul, we immediately think my soul, your soul, when there is just the soul, we're radiance of one. Yeah.
And what's the worst that can happen if you reach out to do something nice? Somebody may shun you or say something nasty to you. Boy, did that hurt you? No. And what you did may be carried as a seed by that person, and they can't quite deal with, why were you nice to me? So, what can it cost us? Nothing.
The courage. Notice that it takes courage with these two comments. And that courage is based on a very different sense of self. In the Declaration, we talk about, as the Lodge, a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. If we are still down in the mire, in the muck of, I am me, I'm this brain, I am this lowly sinner, I'm afraid to do anything for fear I'm going to feel pain or get a consequence. There's no confidence. There's no sense of courage based on spiritual wisdom. But if we move ahead on a truer nature of self, the spirit of the soul, and we rely, we trust, we fall back on that, then we have a whole different sense of immediacy or patience. We can take a longer view. We can be proactive instead of reactive. We can work together and find new ways to develop harmony. Yes?
Well, we were just thinking of those statues that we can't forget. Those female statues, Statue of Liberty. In Fairmount Park, there are wonderful statues. But they're female. Now, it seems that they're shouting out to us what it means for sacrifice for the benefit of others. And all we need to do is remember the sacrifices our mothers and fathers, for that matter, have made for us and what it cost them in pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. So we, in turn, have to understand that word charity, love, and affection for others.
Mm-hmm.
And not spend so much time in front of the mirror worshiping ourselves. It's not a question of karma here, is plain, as you sow, you reap.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we not sowing those ideas?
So sowing those ideas, we have to come to a close, but sowing those ideas of cause and effect. I am soul, I can set up causes, I reap effects, I'm part of a collective doing the same. On the basis of that thought process, redemption is universally possible. There's no savior anywhere outside. Redemption is universally possible, and each of us is far more than the worst thing we've ever done. Far, far more. So if we have mercy within ourselves and measure ourselves as a stone catcher instead of a stone thrower, mercy and justice will be true for all. And I've just quoted Brian Stevenson. Quite a mind. Okay, that's it for today. See you Wednesday night. The doors open at 5:15.